Martin Keaveney Creative Writing. Creative Writing, Intermediate by Remote. Week 4. Presented by Martin Keaveney.
Good evening, and you're all very welcome to week 4 of your Creative Writing Intermediate Remote course. So this is an audio recording of the tutorial section of the course prepared for those of you who cannot attend the live video conference. You will already have received an email containing the PowerPoint presentation package, which contains all of the slides I will be discussing over the next hour or so. So what I would like to do now is check your email if you haven't already done so and download the file named Week 4 that I sent to you. You can pause the audio while you do this if you like. Okay, so you should be now looking at the first slide in the presentation. Quite an interesting piece of art there. You'll see the date and the title, My World. Just to remind you, if you have any questions about any aspect of the course, don't hesitate to email me at info@martinkeaveney.com. Okay, so let's click on now to slide 2. Okay, so tonight we're talking about writing a memoir as our genre focus, and we'll also spend a good part of this section investigating the subject of tone as part of this podcast as well. So you're going to hear a little bit about using tone in your writing. Now, on slide 3, let's establish first what we mean by memoir. So people often confuse memoir with autobiography. Phil Cohen writes that the memoir is a narrative essay organized around a single theme, topic, or situation, which uses selective aspects of the life history, often combined with other material, to explore it in depth. So either as an essay or as a book, it is organized around a certain theme, topic, or situation. It uses selective parts of the subject as a life material, which can be applied with other material, deepening and furthering the reading experience. So a memoir then is different to an autobiography, as it focuses on a certain section of life rather than the whole life story up until now. So it's important to think here now that we've got a couple of scholars, and they're kind of arguing two different viewpoints really on the memoir itself and what a memoir actually is. So Cohen is kind of looking at it in a more historical perspective, while my other scholar that I'm going to discuss here is Matthias, who looks at it more as a piece of art. So on slide 4 there, let's just look a bit more at what Cohen says on the focus element of a memoir. Although it is always based on personal recollection, its focus can be on something other than the author's own life. So you can have a portrait of a parent, a mentor, or a work colleague even, or a particular milieu, he says there, for example. So so just to recap on that, even if it is based on what you experience, or what you know, or what you remember, it does not necessarily have to be about you. You do not have to be the singular focus of the memoir. As Cohen writes, it could be a teacher you had, or which might be the main subject of the work, but it is being told from your experience. So he continues, it is much more difficult for autobiographies to be unself-centered, precisely because they have a more totalizing ambition to unfold the whole life story so far, with the aim of achieving a provisional summing up, some evaluation of its personal meaning and or social significance. So, I mean, yes, of course, memoirs can have an evaluation of the meaning and of the social significance. But I suppose the primary objective is to relate that kind of short period of your life or experience that you had. And whereas the autobiography is a bigger undertaking, a wider scope, for example. So you see, it would be impossible to write that kind of tale in an autobiography, as he says, as it would be much more self-centered. As he says, it is like the life has been summed up in an autobiography, which you've lived, and there is the tendency of evaluating your personal meaning and your social significance. And as I said, that can happen in a memoir, but it doesn't have to, while it would be very difficult to avoid in an autobiography. Now, moving on there to slide 5, let us just look at the clash of history and art, as I was saying, in the relation to writing a memoir, with this article by Frank Matthias, who uses his war experience to write his memoir in his later years. Matthias was a historian himself, But he says that the only historian who may justly add to his story by use of imagination to fill in a bit of the past is the memoirist. For only the memoirist is writing primarily of himself and not of other people and institutions. So this is a question about history and history being fact. Of course, history uses facts and historians will tell you it's fact-based. But the reality is that facts can be sequenced. You know, they can be set up in a sequence to suit a certain agenda. So, you know, there is that kind of essential fictionalizing of facts in a way. So what Matthias is kind of arguing is that in a memoir, you can actually add in your imagination. You can create material in the memoir that doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be empirical evidence, it doesn't have to be factual. In this way, a memoir is just to continue, a memoirist who is writing history is permitted to use his imagination because he is writing on himself and not of other people and institutions. Now, I am aware this is conflicting with Cohen's remarks, so you know this is, as I said at the beginning earlier on, this is a kind of a clash. It is a clash of views, and you'll have to make up your own mind on these views. And a compromise, I suppose, is if you speak of yourself, this is just a suggested compromise, is if you speak of yourself, you can use your imagination. But when we involve other people or establishments, we must tread very, very carefully. Now, even having said that, Matthias continues, he must construct his own personality and those of men and women in his past in a way more akin to the novel than to the historian. For he must involve himself in love affairs and marriage, divorce, birth and death, perhaps even criminal activity. So this is a real kind of, I suppose, dramatizing of an experience, according to Matthias, which is kind of in conflict with a historical kind of framework of trying to stick to the facts. So he is moving away here from Cohen's view and seems to see the memoir as much closer to an artistic object rather than historically privileged version as described by Cohen. So how, in slide 6, let us move on there, how do we use the form of the memoir? And the memoirist, according to Matthias, may devise dialogue, for this enhances the truth and impact of the story. After all, the memoirist was actually there and can remember the theme, if not the exact words used. So, you know, Matthias is saying really that the dialogue can be fabricated as long as you can remember the gist of it, might be the word we would use. I don't know if you agree with that or not. I'm not saying I agree with it, but that is what Matthias is arguing for here. Matthias continues his very artistic view on the memoir, encouraging the use of dialogue, which he says enhances the truth and impact of the story. But is this a good thing? He argues that the memoirist was actually there and can remember the theme, if not the exact words used. We do need to be careful here, or we will indeed be writing fiction with real names. And that's okay as long as you're showing everyone in a good light. But when you start to kind of maybe not say things that are that nice about people, then it becomes a bit more complicated. And that is where you have to be very, very careful. How much of this is memoir and how much of it is historical fiction, which we were working on 2 weeks ago? It becomes historical fiction if it's closer to the facts. And it's a story, it's presented as a story, but a memoir can be taken up by the unsuspecting reader and they think this is actually fact. Now, I would see memoir as an experience of life, but I would think it would be a work that I would be, I mean, I don't write nonfiction, so I don't have to worry about that. But I would be very worried about writing a memoir that wasn't close enough to the truth. I would be wary of fictionalizing, and certainly I'd be very wary about fictionalizing anything that involved actual real life people. You can do that in fiction, but it's a different matter doing it when you're talking about a memoir. Matthias indeed completely abandons any last vestige of history in the memoir with this remark. In short, good readable narrative history may well be art, but it still lacks the imaginative artistic brushwork expected and attainable in a top-flight memoir. Okay, so a top-flight memoir then, according to Matthias, is one that is quasi-fiction, almost fiction. I would not fully agree with this, but it is a matter for yourself to reflect on. Again, as I've said, I would suggest that a memoirist attempts as best they can to realise the truth of the period. I think this will be more attractive to read, and it will be what the reader would think would be expecting to read in a memoir, not something that is very, very fictionalised. Otherwise, they would just pick up a book of fiction. But the Matthias is arguing this, so I think it's interesting to see the viewpoints on that. Now, let's move on to slide 7. What does all this mean for the would-be memoirist? Well, first of all, the focus aspect, as discussed earlier. You need to pick out a particular relevant point in your life that you think would be worth turning into a memoir. The memoir does not have to be self-centered, but I suppose the key thing is the way publishers understand memoirs is that they are from the point of view of the writer. So even if it is about your supervisor, it is still coming from your perspective. The other thing to say is that memoirs are always written in the first person. It would be pretty remarkable to write a memoir in a different form to that. Depending on which of the scholars are referred to, fact and fiction is indeed a delicate balancing act. To me, it is already fictional enough because we are writing it, so that itself is essentially a fictional exercise. It's an exercise in fiction. You're writing the words to page on something you think happened, the way you think it happened. And even if you're being very conscious of the fact that you're trying to be very kind of objective about it, very kind of balanced and non-judgmental, you're still being judgmental. It's impossible to be objective about this memory because it's still a memory that you have, no matter what you do. So to me, that is still a work of fiction. But publishers won't agree with that, of course. And the thing is that readers believe when they buy a memoir that they are reading something that is coming from is very factual, is very true. So, I mean, all we can do, I would suggest, is to work to make it as factual as possible. Otherwise, work by fiction. That's just my opinion. Other people, as you can see, Matthias, he thinks of it as an artwork. He thinks of it as a thing that can be fictionalized. And I'm not saying that there aren't good memoirs that are quite artistic. There are. They're very readable works. But I wouldn't consider them factual representations of a period at all. Same with historical fiction. I still wouldn't consider them to be factual representations of a period because they are arranged by one author, by one person's view of the situation. I would be aiming to write in a memoir as accurate as possible a reflection. This is not telling you how to write a memoir or anything, by the way. I would also feel a neutral tone is essential for that reason, but there again is no rule on that either. And we will talk about tone in a few moments. However, publishers reading memoirs will probably expect usually the tone to be detached. I mean, you can do stylized memoirs, of course you can. You can do fictionalized memoirs as well, which are memoirs about non-existent people. Which is very interesting, and that would be something I wouldn't rule out right in the future. On the other hand, I know anecdotally of many famous novelists who were, not many, but famous novelists who were rejected by publishers because the publishers wanted the book to be a memoir rather than a work of fiction, and presumably thinking that the memoir would be more easier to sell, and they didn't do that and successfully published the work as fiction later on. So there's a few things as attractive, in fact, in publishing or any type of entertainment as something that is with quote marks based on a true story. So tone, as we speak about shortly, is important in memoirs, but I will come to that in a few moments, as I said. So moving on there to slide 8, I think it is essential, in the same as it is with historical fiction, to make sure you research your subject well, even if it is memoir. As Matthias says here, the use of high quality research will help you as you proceed to write. So, for example, if you worked in a fish factory in the 1950s, don't assume that you know everything about the industry at that time. When you do some research, you will inevitably find that research feeding into your writing process. It is not that unlikely that a good research campaign before you start will actually potentially redirect your project completely. Material that you discover in your searching of archives, your searching of newspapers, your discussions with other people that were, for example, working in that fish factory as well, could actually influence the way you approach the whole project. So it is something that there is a much more there can be much more planning in a memoir than there would be with a novel. Indeed, there quite possibly could be a lot more planning, given as it is to an interpretation of facts. You should make sure that you have permission for the use of any images. And as I say in the live course, nowadays it's you don't usually see images in memoirs spread out throughout where you might like to have them, unless they're drawings, of course. If they are images, they're usually all collected in one part of the book, and that's for practical reasons, for printing reasons. But it does affect the fact that your reader will possibly automatically just jump to those images at the start, look at them, and it will of course feed into the way that the narrative is received. Or on the other hand, if they don't do that, if they're very disciplined and just read the book and then get to them, then you might have, for example, if you have before and after pictures of the factory before it was built and after, they can be a kind of a jump, and they can kind of affect the reading of the overall narrative. So it's something to think about with the images, how they will, because they more than likely would be just all jumbled together in one area of the book. Make sure you have obviously permission, and if you're in doubt about referring to real people, you need to obviously seek professional legal advice. The presentation of a memoir is similar to a novel in publishing when you're actually submitting it. You might send in 10,000 words, but the synopsis in this case should definitely answer the question of why you, why this story, and why are you writing it now? These are the three questions that will be the key to whether the publisher will even consider looking at the 10,000 words. Why are you writing it? Why this story? And why are you writing this story now? Unfortunately, these are not very artistic questions at all. But then, as we say, it's questionable whether a memoir is a work of, I suppose it is a work of art, but we are wary of it being too artistic because then it'll be very much fictionalized. So these questions are kind of they're kind of very commercially driven questions, rather than thinking about how this is going to really work as a piece of literature. It's more like what sort of people are going to buy it, and that's the questions the publishers are obviously in a business to sell books. So they're going to be asking the questions of why are you writing it, why are you writing this particular story, and why are you writing this story at this moment in time? What is the relevance of it? You would need to make it easy for the publisher to decide that they are going to publish it. You need to make it also easy for the agent to think that they can get a publisher on board with this project. Let's move on to slide 9 now. So, as it may be clear, the memoir is actually very publishing. This is the good news, is a very publishable proposal for publishers. Readers, as Matthias says here, are easily engaged in a personal recollection of actual events because they will see it as actual events. As I said, they see it as a real story, as a true story, and they will want to share in the experience. The task of the memoirist is to provide that experience as readably and engagingly as possible. Yes, it is not as easy as it sounds, and there are many memoirists out there trying to do the same thing. It's a question I was often asked as a teacher, would we be able to do memoirs in the course? And that's why I've brought this into this intermediate program. Matthias is still here arguing for the artistic value of memoirs, and he seems to be saying it is essential to inject the maximum amount of emotion into the project. Well, whether you go into the historic or the more artistic route, you need to pitch your project in a way, as I said, that will convince the publisher that this will be a success. So if you emphasize those items that Matthias refers to, it will certainly have a better chance, but at least in the synopsis anyway. But it is better that you follow up on what you promise in the synopsis, that you don't they don't love the synopsis and then not find that the book delivers on its promises. So moving on then to slide 10, and we our weekly reading, of course, is a memoir. Well, it's a memoir, it's a type of memoir. It's an example of a recollection of a period from an individual. Some questions to ask of this particular work. Does the author remain focused on historical or background, or the background of the historical background, sorry, of the period, or is the work closer to Matthias's version of an artistic memoir? How is language treated in this particular work? How would you say that the work is structured? And what level of information about the period is given exclusively from the excerpt? Just from the excerpt, what do you learn about the period, if anything? Now, on slide 11, we're getting to the writing exercise section. So this week is a kind of follow-on from last week's exercise, because memoir is a process of rewriting the past. Or writing the past and then rewriting it when you're drafting it. But I want you to take the experience that you wrote about for the children's fiction exercise and now rewrite it as a memoir piece. Now, if you weren't here or you didn't get to last week's exercise or you didn't get to do it, then simply write about an intense experience you had in your life, the most intense if possible. So for the next few minutes, draft something, 5 minutes, let's say, 5 minutes drafting something. And then when you have the kernel of the idea, for the next follow 5 minutes, structure it into a bigger project. And questions to ask before you get started, when you're at this second point, when you have the first sketch done, but don't ask these questions of yourself until you've done the first sketch, is how will you tell the tale? What is the most relevant part from the first draft that you've the sketch that you've just drawn out? And thirdly, why would a reader want to know about this story? So these are useful questions to ask. So first of all, spend 5 minutes drafting something and then ask the three questions. How will you tell the tale? What is the most relevant in your draft? And why would a reader want to know about this? So these are useful questions. So for the next 10 minutes, go ahead with that. Good luck with that. And again, come back to the podcast. Tone is something I'm particularly keen on speaking of because it was something I was pulled up on by my PhD editor. This was after I had been practicing as a writer for 7 years, where I had submitted a novel draft of an adolescent who was still a bit of a ruffian, was a bit of a ruffian to say the least. And the novel was told in the first person, so you can picture this hooligan teenager, and then think of the hooligan teenager using words like smouldering, particularly, and erroneous. Yes, quite a slip. This would be what I'd be considered a slip in tone. The hooligan teenager is not likely to use words like smouldering or effervescent, for example, unless you're talking about a Clockwork Orange type novel where tone is deliberately confused. So most novels adopt a tone, and that tone carries the work. For the new writer, it is more of a challenge to experiment with tone. It is, of course, fun to play around with tone, and we will try it in the course. But it is important to be aware of the presence of tone in your work. So here on slide 12, look at what are the categories of tone. So a neutral tone is perhaps close to an academic piece of writing. Scholarship is written neutrally, sorry. Because the facts, the hard evidence is meant to convince the reader of something and not the rhetorical devices, which can include manipulation of tone. A neutral tone is adopted by some or perhaps many genre writers because what is of key importance is not the tone but the story, or not the style of the writing but the story, and not the language. It's the tone, and the language can extension be mean the tone, of course. So a neutral tone is in effect like no tone, or a flat contemporary language, the language that we use regularly, but not in the way that we speak, because that would be too colloquial. In fact, it is neutral, but even neutral finds it difficult to be not subjective. For example, an American neutral tone is slightly different to an Irish neutral tone, for example. If you want an example of a neutral tone, look at government documentation. If you want to just look at this, detect a slight difference, look at the government documents in one country and another, like in Ireland, and similar documents in the US, for example, and you can detect a difference in their tone, their way of telling you something, even though they're both using the English language. Where would the changes be? They would be in terms of the word, the adjective used, the lengths of the sentences, and whether they were imperatives or not. We worked on children's fiction last week. What is the tone of a child's book? Of course, as we said last week, children's fiction has a vast array of subgenres itself. However, the tone of the child's book is different in because it has to calibrate for the age of the child you are speaking to. Therefore, words must be related to the child's expected learning ability. If you're writing a child's book and you're worried about tone, order a few school books for that age group and look at the tone that they use. For example, a school book for an 11-year-old or 12-year-old would be useful in, if you're writing a child's book and you want to know what tone to adopt. It's just because they will have it measured in terms of the understanding of the expected understanding learning ability of that child at that age. Children's school books, of course, have become more fun in recent generations and closer to that entertaining fiction which children like to read. So it's not a bad route. So they're not children's educational books are not as kind of formal now as they would have been. So it is not a bad route. So what is the formal tone anyway? The formal route is often thought of as 19th century writing, and it is true that the novels of Jane Austen, the Brontes, and Dickens often are very elaborately written with long-winded ways of saying things. The tone is it looks to be heavy-handed in today's terms. Our modern age of fast communication seems at odds with the elaborate letting writing style of the 19th century. So the formal tone is often found, of course, nowadays in legal documents. And if you're writing fiction that involves courtrooms, you need to learn how to write the formal tone. Now, some of these others do merge. An insane turn is perhaps written with long roaming sentences reflecting the lack of civilized parameters. High emotion is often found in an insane tone. One-sided, very one-sided views on things, a lack of reason. This is executed by broken, unfinished sentences sometimes. A stream of consciousness can verge on the insane, even when it is a sane character. The internal thinking can seem quite outrageous at times. The unreliable tone is like insanity. An unreliable narrator is one who is not definitely telling the reader the full story, or it is doubtful whether the reader is getting the full story. Of course, this is often carefully obscured because the reader has to be convinced by the narrator, or to an extent, that this is the quotation marks truth, close quotation marks, while the author has to also at the same time inject doubt at the same time in the way that the narrator is talking so that the reader can possibly detect it, can see it if they look closely enough, but not so much as it weakens the cleverness of the narrator, if you understand what I mean there. The good thing about the podcast is if it is something that is kind of complicated or complex, or if you find difficult to grasp, you can always just simply rewind and go over it again. It really is an art because it needs a balance between telling a story that seems believable but leaves room for suspicion. Complex actions, times, dates, emphasis on the unusual are often techniques used here by authors to execute an unreliable narrator. A timid narrator is one that is passive, that does not very do very much, except narrate and rarely offers much of an opinion on anything. When they do, their opinions are, you know, similar to others. They're kind of a modified version of somebody else's. They're kind of trained into a duplicate. To duplicate the stronger characters. So the other characters, I mean, some people would argue that the Harry Potter series is an example of this, where Harry Potter, of course, it is third person narration, but the main character of Harry Potter is quite a he's often kind of passive in terms of things kind of happen to him more so than him making things happen. You often see it. The Girl on the Train is another example of a novel where the character is quite timid, the main character, and okay, she does react in certain situations, but a lot of the time she's quite passively watching, passively observing what is happening. So that is often achieved by also by a neutral tone as well as the actions, but the tone is also couched in the indigenous speech of the narrator. Arrogance, an arrogant tone, rather than just defining these motions. Of course, I'm trying to give you an example of the way that they would be executed in fiction, but it's kind of unavoidable that I'm defining these things as well. So that's kind of just a kind of an accident, I suppose, as it were, in terms of the way I'm defining these tones. An arrogant tone must communicate a character of you which is arrogant, often achieved by self-satisfied language such as assumptions. The character makes assumptions, a language that promotes the character feeling like that they are the center of the universe. So this can be achieved also by out of sync language, basically them not listening to other characters, or actually using the long-winded words, those long-winded words as a schoolboy, which are not really in sync with the fact that they're an adolescent. So for example, this is nicely demonstrated through A Clockwork Orange. One of the key traits of Alex in A Clockwork Orange is long, you know, ridiculously long words, unbridled arrogance. He doesn't go to school, yet he knows all these words, such as gorgeousity is one of his phrases, even though he's an adolescent narrative. So in this sense, you get across, you can communicate the sense of arrogance in the main character. An arrogance which has to be, of course, in the not getting into Clockwork Orange too much, but in the US version of it, he doesn't ever really achieve redemption, so his arrogance is kind of never actually dies, whereas in the original version it is kind of, he is kind of redeemed as a character, I suppose, and that kind of is what is kind of set up if you're using an arrogant character, that they were the expectation is that they are going to be taught a lesson, as it were. What other tones are there? Look at the books on your shelf and consider the tone of some of them. Do you think of tone as you write? As I have been saying, this is not something, definitely not something to consider in the early drafting process, in my opinion. I think it is something that you look at in your later revisions. So in slide 13, here are some more practical places to refine and adjust tone. Obviously, the view of the character, both practically and metaphysically, affects their tone of telling a story. This leads to questions of the word choice, the length of sentences, as I said, and the format of the tale, whether it is like Jekyll and Hyde, a series of journal entries, letters, reports, or Sally Rooney, just a series of vignettes. The format, of course, affects the tone of the work. Dialogue in a dialogue, of course, is key. In a courtroom, it's often long speeches, whereas in a schoolyard, it will be short, quick, fast retorts. And finally, the censorship. Yeah, so what I mean here is whether or not you censor out the swear words. Of course, the swear word will affect the tone of the piece, or sexual scenes, or violence. Do you consider the use of a swear word as lowering the tone of a book or a story? Can one curse make much difference? These are just questions to reflect on, or not. Should you use a curse? Should you not? One curse could make a difference. Or if there are many curses, too many curses, will that affect the tone? Thinking about this emphasizes the importance of regulating the tone in your work. So moving to slide 14 then, tone homework. So for our submission this week, perhaps you can try out some of these tones, neutral, insane, or unreliable, if you'd like. So that's the tone tutorial. Of course, if you have any questions, let me know. Slide 15, we'll be doing the workshop. And then slide 16, you're asked to write a piece of your memoir in prose. Use the class exercise if you wish. Aim for up to 2,000 words. You can write a lot less if you wish. And share it with the peer group. And I will be sending on a new peer group shortly. Prepare some, at this stage of the course, prepare some brief verbal comments for your peers' work and also on this week's reading. We're moving on to non-fiction for week 5. So, as I said in slide 17, there the reading will be sent on over the coming days. Please try to read the other work by your peers and don't forget to submit your own piece. It's good to start as soon as possible if you can and try and get it in as close to the deadline as you can possibly can, but I understand that that can be difficult. Prepare some brief verbal comments, as I said, for your peers' work. Okay, that's the end of the podcast. Thanks a lot for listening and have a very good week's writing.
Produced with Audacity and Martin Kibany Creative Writing. Music track Thornhorn by Alexander Nakarada, SerpentSoundStudios.com. Please note this recording is for your personal use and should not be shared or published in any way. Martin Kibany Creative Writing 2020.